You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like. Welcome to the layer cake, son.
Hello, welcome back once again to another episode of the File and Claw Audiobook Archive presentation of Triumphant Plutocracy, aka Imperial Washington, the story of American public life from 1870 to 1920, written in 1922 by the first state senator from South Dakota, Richard Franklin Pettigrew. Alright, and this is going to be part number 13 of this audiobook recording, where we've been taking a look at what are essentially the memoirs of Rich Pettigrew, who had a very interesting and kind of short political life, but who was in Washington, D.C. in the Senate, right in the belly of the beast at a time when the robber barons were really taking over the country. And he writes very unapologetically about this, and gives a very authoritative account, I feel, at least, of what was really happening in America during that time. Now, a lot has been written since then, and there are people who make the case that the robber barons were not real, and these were just men of great ingenuity, but because they got rich, people were jealous and envious of them. Whereas the truth of the matter is a little farther afield, and I think that Pettigrew here, because he was actually in the Senate and saw what happened, and he writes about exactly how bribes are distributed, and how these people are corrupted, and how lobbying for some company sways even the judge's opinion, right? Somebody who's supposed to be so impartial and fair, how they are swayed by being a lawyer, and how lawyers have ran the Senate and the government pretty much throughout the history of the country, and how lawyers are the only people who can take a bribe legally. They just call it a fee. So these are the type of things he writes about. And in the last couple chapters, we've had some absolutely explosive revelations, I feel, about instances where he claims that the United States government actually rewrites history to suit its own purposes and changes official records. So, very interesting. Very interesting. But, yeah, this is kind of a... It's not a scholarly work, but the information in here is good, and it comes from a person of authority. This isn't some writer, right? This guy's not a writer, he's not an author, he's not a historian, not a journalist. This is just a man who happened to sit in there. He came from out in the country, right? You know, I mean, South Dakota barely had become a state when he got elected in the Senate. But it comes from somebody who sat inside, he looked at things, he saw them for what they were, and he was confused, you know. He even says in the book that, you know, he didn't understand how this was happening, how he had been taught his whole life that America is this great and virtuous country, and then, you know, he goes in there to serve and do right by the people, you know, like I'm sure every politician does. And he gets in there and he just sees this as like nothing but a bribe fest, nothing but a pay-to-play type of system. And he's baffled by it, and so he goes back and looks through the history of the country, and he finds out, well, hey, this is how it's always been. And he wonders, how come nobody is telling anybody this? And so that's what the memoirs are for. He said very specifically in the intro that he is writing this to let his fellow countrymen know that this is the way the system is, this is the way, as far as he can tell, that it's always worked. And this is kind of a warning. So let's see what his warning was. Let's continue on with the book and see why this book is not well distributed or not well known. I mean, I'm sure hardly anybody knows about this book. I don't know if you could even find any reviews of it anywhere on the internet, but I just happened to stumble across it, and I find it pretty interesting so far. So, without any further chit-chatting, let's get right into it today. As always, I will be attempting to keep the recording down to 1 hour in length for easy digestion and consumption of the material. I will only be stopping to offer any insight or interpretation with the book because, well, we're not just trying to do rote memorization of the facts. Sometimes a little insight gets your brain, you know, flowing, gets it rolling, helps you crunch all this data that's coming in. I'll also only be stopping to spell any last names because I may butcher their pronunciation. Also, it would be much easier for you, if you know how to spell these names, to go into your search engine of choice and look these people up. There's a lot of obscure characters from American history who may deserve further scrutinization. So, if there's any words that are archaic, since this was written almost 100 years ago now, there may be some words that we don't use anymore. Anything I have to look up, I will include the definition of those into the reading. So, nothing wrong with expanding your vocabulary, and if you know what the word is already, well, then hey, you're a step ahead of me. Also, if there's any footnotes in the book, I will be including them in the reading, either just the number, or if it's longer than just a citation, I'll actually read it into the book. Now, I post all these archives online on the website, which is fileandclaw322.wordpress.com. Or, as a backup, you can go onto Twitter and find my profile. It's at fileandclaw322. Now, with all these audio recordings that I post online, if there's any footnotes, I will post them in plain text along with the recording. So, you can go through, and if there's anything you find incredible, you can look at the footnotes. Unfortunately, this book doesn't have many footnotes because it's the memoirs of a man, so you just got to take it for what it is. He has included some figures and tables and charts in the book, so if there's any of those that I come across while reading, I will post those tables and charts on the website for you to take a look at. other than that, let's get right into it today. We're going to be moving right along now. This is part 3, The Machinery of Government, chapter number 15, 10 Presidents. Now, I have personally acquainted with every president of the United States from Andrew Johnson to Woodrow Wilson. With some of them, my acquaintance was very slight. Others I knew intimately for many years. I saw enough of all of them to form a pretty definite idea of their qualities. These 10 presidents were not brainy men. They were not men of robust character. They were pliable men, safe men, conservative men. Many of them were usable men who served faithfully the business interests that stood behind them. All but two of them were lawyers, and they took into the presidency the peculiar limitations under which lawyers suffer. I met Grant first in his first term, in the winter of 1871-72. And our acquaintance lasted as long as he lived. Grant was a soldier, not a president, but he filled the office as acceptably as a general could be expected to do. Among the 10 presidents, I am of the opinion that Benjamin Harrison was preeminent in ability and character. He was elected in 1888, beating Cleveland, who was then a candidate for a second term. Although Harrison was a strong man, he was not a leader. He misjudged the political machinery of the Republican Party and had a reputation of being the most ungrateful person that ever occupied the White House. At the outset, he proclaimed his opposition to bosses and to machine control in the Republican Party. As soon as he was elected president, he began to build up a machine of his own, using his patronage as a bait and a whip, and disregarding the leaders and bosses entirely. Soon after I came to the Senate in December 1889, I went to see the president about some of the appointments in the state of South Dakota, which had just been admitted into the Union. The president immediately gave me to understand that he thought I was the political boss of Dakota, and that he would have to look into the recommendations which I made. I do not think he ever appointed anyone to any political position because of my endorsement. I am informed that he treated the leaders in the other states in the same manner. Any sort of president, Republican or Democrat, can renominate himself for a second term. The power that he holds through his patronage and his veto enables him to appeal to the personal interest of a large number of influential men and thus to compel their support. Interesting. The Republican leaders were strongly opposed to Harrison and to his re-election. Quay and Cameron of Pennsylvania, Farwell of Chicago, Tom Platt of New York, and a large number of others held conference after conference with a view to choosing his successor. And real quick, those names, a couple that we haven't hit on. Quay, that's Q-U-A-Y of Pennsylvania, and Farwell of Chicago, that's F-A-R-W-E-L-L. Continuing with the book. They knew the power of the machine that the president had built up, and knew it was difficult to accomplish their purpose, but after much consideration they finally decided at a meeting which I attended to persuade Blaine to be a candidate. And that person's last name is Blaine, B-L-A-I-N-E. It had been the ambition of Blaine's life to be president, and we had hoped to get him into the field as the only person who could beat Harrison. He was at the time a member of Harrison's cabinet and Secretary of State. Alright, so that kind of places him. He is Secretary of State Blaine. I was delegated to see Blaine and to report on his attitude. I went to Blaine's house on McPherson Square in front of the White House and had several conversations with him. In every instance, he said that he would accept the nomination, but that he would not seek it, nor would he be a candidate. At the last interview, just before we went to Minneapolis for the National Convention, he told me that, in his opinion, if he were nominated, he would not live through the campaign because of the bad state of his health. Therefore, he was resolved to do nothing to aid in securing his nomination. When we arrived at the convention, we found everything cut and dried for Harrison's renomination, and he was nominated almost immediately. After the nomination had been made, a committee of his followers came to us, and by us I mean the political managers of the Republican Party in the various states of that date, and wanted us to name the vice president. We replied that we would do nothing of the kind. It was their ticket, nominated without even consulting us, and it was their job to elect it. Levi P. Morton, M-O-R-T-O-N, was vice president and president of the Senate during Harrison's first term. He was a capable and cordial gentleman of whom we were all very fond, and we supposed, of course, that he would be nominated by Harrison's crowd. But he was passed over, and White Law Reed was nominated in his place. And just as a quick aside here, that name White Law Reed, his name W-H-I-T-E-L-A-W, that's his first name, and Reed, the last name R-E-I-D. And just an interesting note, Rich Pettigrew puts his name in all capital letters, so I don't know if he's just stunned that they chose White Law Reed or exactly why he did that, but just an interesting note there. Continuing on with the book. There was a great deal of discussion over the matter, and reporters tried to interview us on the outcome of the convention. We all refused to be interviewed, but one reporter did get into Quay's room and asked him what he thought of the ticket put up at Minneapolis. Quay gazed out of the window and, in his quaint way, said, quote, "It looks as though it might snow," unquote. And I guess that shows he didn't have much enthusiasm, huh? I returned to Washington before any of the other senators, and the moment I went upon the floor of the Senate, Morton, who was in the chair, came over to where I was sitting and, in a very hurt tone of voice, wanted to know why he was not nominated with Harrison. I told him the facts, that Harrison's followers had sent a delegation to us asking to name the vice president, that we told them it was their ticket, and that they would have to elect it, and therefore they should designate Harrison's running mate. I added, quote, "We supposed, of course, that they would nominate you, but we also believe that Harrison will be defeated, and therefore we did not wish to participate in the nomination," unquote. Harrison selected for the important post of chairman of the Republican National Committee, Senator Carter of Montana. Now, Tom Carter was a bright man. He was a lawyer, of considerable ability and had a wide knowledge of the law. But he was ignorant of the methods employed by the Republican Party machine to win a campaign. Carter did not know how to go about reaching the bankers, the railroad financiers, the trust magnates, and the other exploiters who control the surplus of American wealth. He did secure a contribution of $400,000 from Cramp, the shipbuilder, by telling Cramp that if he put up $400,000, it would, beyond a doubt, elect Harrison. Oh, yes, of course, everybody, it's just that simple. $400,000 and your man will get elected. Oh, I bet that guy got totally screwed. And that man's name is Cramp, C-R-A-M-P, the shipbuilder. Don't know who he is. Might be somebody interesting to look up. Apparently, he bought the line, hook, line, and sinker, that $400K would elect Harrison for a second term. Alright, continuing on with the book here. He also told Cramp where the money would be laid out in order to secure this result, and assured him that he would see that Cramp got the money back out of building ships for the government as soon as Harrison took office. Now, campaign funds were not usually raised in this rough fashion. Oh, come on, Pettigrew, are you serious? That's not how campaign funds are raised. Come on. I question that assertion of his. Alright, sorry. Let's carry on with the book here. Campaign funds were not usually raised in this rough fashion. Instead, the campaign managers went to the real government. Oh, hello. The real government, the managers of the railroads, the great industrial, financial, and transportation interests, and secured their contribution without any direct promise as to the method of using the funds, leaving that to come along as a matter of course in case of success. Alright, you know what? I'll pull that last comment back. You know, fair enough. Pettigrew lays it out. He's like, you know, they didn't have to make a direct promise like, look, you give me that money and I'll make sure you're taken care of. These guys know the score because, as he just said, they are the real government, the big contributors. And back in the day, they were industrial, financial, and transportation interests and the managers of the railroad. Those were the real government. Well, nowadays, it's people like Goldman Sachs and General Dynamics and the Bank of America, people like that. The real government. And they don't have to get any promises. There doesn't need to be any promises. There's just the word that, hey, you know, we'll take care of you. It's a known thing. They'll take care of each other. And if you want a good example of that, well, we actually caught it on a hot mic a couple years back when old Rick Perry was out campaigning to be president.
Bank of America, we will help you out. Bank of America, we will help you out. Bank of America, we will help you out.
And yes, my friends, that's just how it goes. Just like Pettigrew says in the book here. So let's continue on now. Had the Republican managers been in control of the campaign, none of these sources would have been neglected. As it was, while Tom Carter's crowd was fooling around, these sources of funds were preempted by Grover Cleveland, who was the Democratic candidate against Harrison. As a result of this mismanagement, Harrison was badly beaten at the polls, and Grover Cleveland was elected in his place. Never do I hope to deal with a more difficult human being than Grover Cleveland. His naturally perverse disposition was supplemented by personal habits that made it next to impossible for anyone to work with him. In the Senate of the United States on June 3, 1896, I made a speech on the River and Harbor Bill that was then under consideration. Cleveland had vetoed the bill, and while I was opposed to it, I felt bound to vote for its passage over the veto because I believed that the president had violated his oath of office by vetoing the bill. I believe that the veto power was never intended by the Constitution or its framers to be used as a legislating instrument. In that speech, I referred to Grover Cleveland as follows. Quote, "The present occupant of the White House is not content with the violation of the Constitution by the exercise of the veto power alone, but with an utter disregard of his sacred oath of office, as well as the Constitution. He overrides the laws, influences congressmen with patronage, enriches his favorites at the public expense, in fact, permits no restraint but his imperial will. I think he might fairly be charged with high crimes and misdemeanors. He has exercised the veto power in direct violation of the Constitution. He has appointed men to office without the advice and consent of the Senate. He has defied the Senate and the Constitution alike by appointing men to official positions after the Senate has twice refused its consent and still retains them in office. During his first term, he openly used his appointing power to intimidate members of Congress, and during his second term, he had given appointments to members of Congress for the purpose of securing their votes upon measures pending in the two houses. On his own motion, he has undertaken to overthrow the Hawaiian government, doing acts in direct violation of the Constitution. He has borrowed money in violation of the law for ordinary expenses of the government, and then falsified the facts in relation thereto in a message to Congress. He has refused to remit taxes as required by law, and has collected taxes unlawfully. He has refused to enforce the laws of Congress so often that the list of violations is next only to the list of his vetoes. he has sold bonds at private sale to his favorites and former associates upon terms and at a price many millions of dollars below the market price of the bonds on the day of such private sales. In view of these facts, it is time for Congress to give some attention to these usurpations. If this government is to survive, we can no longer look with indifference upon the shameful autocracy of Grover Cleveland. Unquote. In this connection, I referred to his veto record as unparalleled in our history and showed that he had vetoed up to the 1st of May, 1896, 551 bills in his 2 terms as president, while all other presidents of the United States together had vetoed but 109 bills passed by Congress. Well, I think he makes a good point. Cleveland was reputed to have certain rugged virtues. The only one that I remember his friends boasting about was that he would do as he agreed. He continued his career as a vetoer until the end of his term, or rather, until the end of January 1897. During February, he was reported to be so drunk that he was incapacitated from public business. A prominent Democratic member of Congress told me, at that time, that he went to the White House to see the president and found Cleveland lying on the floor in a rather hilarious state of intoxication. I wonder if any of that ever got into the newspapers. January or February of 1897. Let me throw that on my never-ending list of stuff to research and look up, but let's pull up some old newspapers from February 1897 on Cleveland. All right, continuing on now. Many other stories of a similar character, and many of them worse, came to our ears during the last days of his disgraceful administration. Most of the great appropriation bills were passed during the closing days of Congress. An act of Congress having been sent to the President must be vetoed by him within 10 days, otherwise it becomes a law without his signature if Congress is in session. If Congress expires during the 10 days, the unsigned bill is not a law, and this is called a pocket veto. Cleveland thus vetoed all of the bills which were sent to him during the last 10 days of Congress. Thus he made it necessary for his successor, McKinley, to call an extra session of Congress immediately in order to pass the appropriation bills and thus secure sufficient funds for the running of the government. On the 4th of March, Grover Cleveland came to the Senate, as is the custom, to see his successor inaugurated. My seat was the first seat on the main aisle. Grover Cleveland was brought in by 2 or 3 men and placed in a chair right across the aisle from me. He was still stupidly intoxicated. His face was bloated, and he was a sight to behold. He did not seem to know what was occurring, but looked like a great lump of discolored flesh. When McKinley had delivered his address and had taken his oath of office, Cleveland was carried out of the Senate by the men who brought him in, and I understand was loaded into a carriage and taken to the wharf in Washington, and there loaded on a yacht, and I think it was Benedict's yacht, He was a very wealthy man, a citizen of New York, and was one of the chief factors in running Cleveland's administration in the interests of big business. All right, so here a very interesting name, Benedict, B-E-N-E-D-I-C-T. No further information. I'm sure that's his last name, but he was a wealthy man and citizen of New York and one of the chief factors in running Cleveland's administration. So, there you go. Probably another person to look into. All right, let me get on with the book here. The yacht sailed down the Potomac with Cleveland for a few weeks so that he could wind up his spree. I have not written about Grover Cleveland for the purpose of attacking him or his private life or from any feeling of personal animosity or ill will, but because these things are a part, and a vital part, of his public and official life as President of the United States, and account for his erratic conduct as Chief Executive of this great nation, and no accurate history of his career as president can be written and fail to consider the two Clevelands, drunk and sober. His ultimatum to England in the Venezuela affair, his conduct with regard to Hawaii, and his hundreds of vetoes and his bond sales in violation of his oath and of the Constitution can in this way only be accounted for. None of his successors approached Cleveland in personal uncleanliness, but the political records of some of them were far from enviable. McKinley. I took my seat in the Senate in December of 1889. During that session of Congress, the McKinley Tariff Bill was under discussion in the House of Representatives, and I think the only thing for which I was interested in having tariff protection was metallic tin cassiterite. I interviewed members of the House Committee, of which William McKinley was chairman, and I asked that a certain duty be placed on metallic tin. La Follette of Wisconsin, who is now Senator La Follette, was a member of this committee, and that last name L-A-F-O-L-L-E-T-T-E. I had known him from boyhood, and we were good friends. Consequently, he promised to attend to the matter of the tariff on tin for me. However, I saw nearly every member of the committee, including the chairman, Mr. McKinley, and I got from McKinley a definite promise that he would do all he could to secure the tariff I wanted on metallic tin. And Dalzell of Pennsylvania, and that last name, D-A-L-Z-E-L-L, was a member of the committee from Pittsburgh where they made tin plate. His clients wanted a very high tariff on tin plate, but wanted the metallic tin to come in free of duty so that the manufacturers of the black plates might make an added profit. Dalzell told me that he was opposed to any tariff upon metallic tin, which made me still more active until I thought I had the promise of the majority of the committee to stand for a tariff on metallic tin. When the matter came up for a vote in the committee, I think the whole committee was present, the vote on the tin schedule was a tie. The chairman, McKinley, was compelled to cast the deciding vote, and he voted against the duty and against what he had specifically promised me. La Follette immediately wrote down the names of the committee members who had voted for and against the tariff on tin, and also the fact that McKinley had cast the deciding vote against me, and sent it by a page over to the Senate. I went over to the House of Representatives, and as I went up on the floor of the House in the direction of McKinley's seat, I met McKinley in the aisle, coming from the session of the Tariff Committee. McKinley, I asked, how are you getting along with the duty on metallic tin? He was very patronizing and conciliating. Well, Senator, he said, I do not believe we can get it through my committee. How in the devil do you expect to get it through your committee, I replied, when you vote against it yourself? He shrank a little under my remark. Then he rallied and said, well, I concluded that it was not best to put a duty on metallic tin. If you had told me that in the first place, I answered, instead of lying to me about it, I would have some respect for you. That would have given me a chance to have worked a little harder and to find someone on the committee that would tell the truth. The incident gave me an insight into McKinley's character and may possibly have had something to do, in addition to other things, with my walking out of the St. Louis Convention in 1896 after McKinley's nomination. I always had the impression that the course pursued by McKinley in the committee of the House was characteristic of the man, and I am still of the opinion that as president he continued the same practices. There is nothing that better illustrates President William McKinley than this agreement with the Sultan of Sulu and his double dealing in connection with the same. I quote from the Congressional Record of January 21, 1900. And that guy, the Sultan of Sulu, last name S-U-L-U. But let's get on here with this quoting from the Congressional Record. Quote, this is a Manila special July 12, 1899. General Bates, in the capacity of agent of the United States government, sailed for Yolo this morning to negotiate with the Sultan of Yolo regarding the future relations of the Yolo or Sulu archipelago, including the Basilians as a naval station. The Sultan assumes that the Yolos reverted to him, the evacuation of the Spaniards nullifying the Treaty of 1878. General Bates will explain to the Sultan that the Americans succeeded the Spaniards in the treaty, assuming its obligations and continuing the annuities it provides for. He will also present to the Sultan $10,000 in Mexican money as an evidence of goodwill. The local administration of the Yolos will remain unchanged. The Sultan will enforce the law and also be expected to fly the American flag continuously and cooperate with America to maintain order and suppress piracy. General Bates then entered into the following agreement. Agreement between Brigadier General John C. Bates, representing the United States, of the one part, and His Highness, the Sultan of Sulu, it being understood that this agreement will be in full force only when confirmed by the President of the United States, and will be subject to future modifications by the mutual consent of the parties in interest. I deem it proper to state that this agreement has been confirmed by the President of the United States in the letter transmitting the treaty to the Senate. However, this is a treaty apparently with a quasi-sovereign power over which the Senate, according to our new doctrine of imperialism, has no other authority and no control, and it requires no ratification by the Senate and no consideration on our part. Article 1. The sovereignty of the United States over the whole archipelago of Sulu and its dependencies is declared and acknowledged. Article 2. The United States flag will be used in the archipelago of Sulu and its dependencies on land and sea. Article 3. The rights and dignities of His Highness the Sultan and his datos shall be fully respected. All their religious customs shall be respected, and no one shall be persecuted on account of his religion. Article 4. While the United States may occupy and control such points in the archipelago of Sulu as public interests seem to demand, encroachment will not be made upon the lands immediately about the residence of His Highness the Sultan, unless military necessity requires such occupation in case of war with a foreign power, and where the property of individuals is taken, due compensation will be made in each case. Article 10. Any slave in the archipelago of Sulu shall have the right to purchase freedom by paying to the master the usual market value. Article 12. At present, Americans or foreigners wishing to go into the country should state their wishes to the Moro authorities and ask for an escort. But it is hoped that this will become unnecessary as we know each other better. Article number 13. The United States will give full protection to the Sultan and his subjects in case any foreign nation shall attempt to impose upon them. Article 14. The United States will not sell the island of Sulu or any other island of the Sulu archipelago to any foreign nation without the consent of the Sultan of Sulu. Article number 15. The United States government will pay the following monthly salaries. To the Sultan, $250. To Dato Muda, $75. To Dato Attic, $60. To Dato Kalbi, $75. To Dato Wakinin, $75. To Dato Puyo, $60. To Dato Amir Hassin, $60. To Habji Butter, $50. To Habib Murrah, $40. To Serif Saguin, $15. Signed in triplicate in English and Sulu at Yolo, this 20th day of August, A.D. 1899, 13th Araquil Akil 1317, the Sultan, Sulu, Raja Huda, Dato Attic, Dato Kalbi, Dato Wakinin, and signed J.C. Bates, Brigadier General, USV. Oh my god, that was long. And let me hit, I'm not going to hit all those names, but I just want to say that I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but in this report here, this report from Manila or wherever it is, they keep spelling or referring to Sulu as, I'm guessing it's YOLO, but it's J-O-L-O. That's how it's spelled, J-O-L-O. Let me carry on here. The annual aggregate of these salaries is $9,120. The Spanish agreement was for $6,300 a year. This agreement was one we offered to the Sultan, not one that he insisted upon. It is our own proposition that we are to maintain slavery in the Sulu Islands. Farther than that, Mr. President, an investigation would show that, although this agreement was made on the 20th day of August, it was not possible to secure from the State Department a copy of the agreement until after the election in Ohio. I say this agreement, when the Associated Press tried to get a copy of it before the Senate convened, was furnished in Arabic, and an Arabic used in the Sulu Islands. Therefore, it was not possible to have it translated in the United States, and we only got this copy, which I have read after Congress convened, and after the elections last fall were over. This is on a par and in line with the whole business of concealing from the American people the facts in regard to our maiden foreign venture. We are unable to procure the truth through General Otis. Mr. Collins of the Associated Press says the censor told him he was to send nothing and they were going to allow nothing to be sent that would injure the administration or help Mr. Bryan. Here is an agreement by which we are to maintain not only slavery, but polygamy in the Sulu Islands. Here is an agreement by which our flag is made to float over two crimes, and we further solemnly agree that no nation in the world shall be permitted to interfere. It is the chief part of the business of the Sultan of Sulu to get into quarrels with the natives of the interior in the island of Mindanao, than to declare that they are in revolt against his authority. Upon this pretext, he takes prisoners and sells them into slavery, the planters of Borneo being the purchasers. That has been his business heretofore, whenever he needed money. We now propose to maintain that sort of thing under the flag of the United States, and we stipulate, and the stipulation is approved by the President, that no foreign nation shall be permitted to interfere. Mr. Spooner, does the Senator wish to be understood as asserting that the President approved Article 10 of this agreement, which refers to slavery in the archipelago of Sulu? Mr. Pettigrew, I do. Mr. Spooner, well, the President says in his message, and if the Senator will permit me, I will read it. Quote, I have confirmed said agreement, subject to the action of the Congress, and with the reservation which I have directed shall be communicated to the Sultan of YOLO, that this agreement is not to be deemed in any way to authorize or give the consent of the United States to the existence of slavery in the Sulu Archipelago. I communicate these facts to the Congress for its information and action. By Mr. Pettigrew. The President approves of an agreement which provides that the slave may purchase his liberty at the usual market price, and according to the first paragraph of the agreement, it goes in full force upon the approval of the President, and cannot after that be altered except by another agreement. This transaction is on par with all the other inconsistencies attached to this miserable business. He then says that he wants the Sultan to understand that he does not authorize slavery, though he has approved the agreement which ratifies slavery. How could he transmit the agreement to us with his approval and then send back word to the Sultan that he did not wish to understand as approving slavery? Who knows whether or not the word will ever get to the Sultan? Almost everything we receive here in regard to this matter is on par with the transmittal to the Associated Press of a copy of the Sulu Agreement in Sulu Arabic, to conceal the infamy until after the elections were over last fall. It is on par with the statements of the commissioners who made this agreement, which I shall proceed to read. Mr. Sherman, in an interview, says, "It seems to me that were it not for the ignorance displayed, the present hue and cry about polygamy and slavery in these islands would be absolutely criminal." If it were not for the ignorance displayed, the present hue and cry about polygamy and slavery would be absolutely criminal. I suppose the hue and cry about slavery before our Civil War was criminal. Many people so asserted. Many people honestly so believed, and I presume that Mr. Sherman honestly believes that the hue and cry about polygamy and slavery again existing under the flag of the United States would be criminal but for the ignorance of the people who cause it. In taking over the Sulu group, we have acquired no rights of any sort there except those bequeathed us by Spain. And yet the President, time and again during last fall in his speeches everywhere, made to the people, asserted that the flag meant the same thing everywhere, meant the same here, in the Sulu group, and in Hawaii, that it meant in every place the same, and that its presence conferred liberty and happiness upon the people under it. Well, there's something to be said about that now, isn't there? Continuing on. She was bound by her agreement with the Sultan not to interfere with the religion or customs of the islands, and it would be most unwise for us to attempt this by force when it can be ultimately accomplished by the slower method of civilization and education. Mr. President, we tried the slower method of disposing of slavery and polygamy in the United States, also the slower method of civilization, but finally we resorted to war, the greatest war in modern times, and thereby succeeded in destroying slavery under our flag. It has been restored by the act of a president elected by the Republican Party. How will it strike the veterans of that war to annex slavery after all these sacrifices and then propose to abolish it when the slaveholders conclude it is wrong and give their consent? The Sulu group proper contains about 100,000 inhabitants. They are all Mohammedans. To attempt to interfere with the rebellion of these people would precipitate one of the bloodiest wars in which this country has ever been engaged. They are religious fanatics of the most pronounced type, who care nothing for death and believe that the road to heaven can be attained by killing Christians. Polygamy is a part of their religion, and slavery, about which so much is being said just now, is a mild type of feudal homage. The Sultan believes from what he has seen of Americans that they are ready to be friendly and deal honestly by him. Mr. President, I will show what kind of feudal homage this slavery in the Philippines is. Owing to the fact that these people will fight, we prefer to enforce slavery and polygamy, and we attack the Christians in the islands of Luzon and compel them to surrender what? Surrender their desire for a government of their own? We prefer to turn from polygamy and slavery and endorse them, put our flag over them, and declare that nobody shall interfere with them, and then turn our armies and our navies to the destruction of the independence and freedom of a Christian population which we also purchased from Spain. I will read from the second edition of Mr. Foreman's book, that last name, Foreman, which was published in 1899 and brought up to date. He says, quote, "The Sultanate is hereditary under the Salic law. The Sultan is supported by three ministers, one of whom acts as regent in his absence, for he might have to go to Mecca if he had not previously done so. The other is minister of war, and the third is minister of justice and master of the ceremonies. Slavery exists in a most ample sense. There are slaves by birth and others by conquest, such as prisoners of war, insolvent debtors, and those seized by piratical expeditions to other islands. A Creole friend of mine, Don A. M., was one of these last. He had commenced clearing an estate for cane growing on the Negro's coast some years ago, when he was seized and carried off to Sulu Island. In a few years he was ransomed and returned to the Negros, where he formed one of the finest sugar haciendas and factories in the colony. Unquote. I now read from Social History of the Races of Mankind by Featherman. Slavery exists on Sulu Island, and the slaves who were formerly brought from the Philippines are not well treated, for their masters exercise the power of life and death over them, and sometimes kill them for trifling offenses. The datos frequently punish a disobedient or fugitive slave by drying their kamplain, or kris, and cutting off his head at one strike without process of law. And this is the mild form of feudal homage Sherman would have us believe would enjoy the protection of our flag until we can persuade the slaveholders that it is wrong. Why did Sherman make this statement? The reason is plain. He did it just before the elections, about the time the State Department gave out the Sulu Arabic copy of the treaty for the information of the people of the United States. I contend that after this statement, made at the time it was made by Mr. Sherman, with an evident purpose to deceive, he has forfeited all right to be believed by anybody hereafter, and that his statements on all subjects in relation to the Philippines are not worthy of credence. I read also from St. John's Far East, Volume 2, page 192, as follows. The slaves are collected from all parts of the archipelago, from Akin Head in New Guinea, and from the south of Siam to the most northern parts of the Philippines. It is a regular slave market. Then he describes the people. Not only have the slaveholders the right of life and death over their slaves, but the monarch himself has complete and full right to take the life of any of his subjects whenever he chooses. There is no restraint upon him. Unquote. Whew! And that is, that's a long, long, long passage there. Let me just try to break that down just a little bit, because it goes on and on and on and on. But essentially, this is Pettigrew reading from the official congressional testimony of January 21st, 1900, so right from the congressional record. And this was a agreement, or essentially, I guess, a purchase of a treaty for the Sulu Islands that William McKinley was sponsoring with between him and the Sultan of Sulu. And basically, Pettigrew is pretty irked about this. I mean, you have to think about it. This was only 30-something years after the Civil War, where we supposedly abolished slavery and everything it stood for. And yet we're negotiating a treaty with this Sultan of the Sulu Islands, whereby we will protect him and fly our flag over his country and prevent foreigners from attacking his little island nation, and yet he will still be allowed to preserve his culture, whereby he drafts slaves and captures wives and has a big harem. And so obviously Pettigrew found this distasteful and in bad spirits, and it seems like, obviously, they're trying to pry this country open. I'm not sure on the complete background of what happened there. Again, might be another thing to look into. But he is quoting chapter and verse here and just ripping through all the facts that, hey, slavery goes on here. How can we fly our flag over a slaver nation when we just finished sacrificing hundreds of thousands of men, of our countrymen, during the Civil War? So, maybe he makes a good point, but I'm sorry that goes on and on and on and on, but that's what he's trying to illustrate there. Let's continue on with the book. I don't think I'm going to make it through this whole chapter in this episode, so we're going to have to split it off, but let me see here. Actually, no, I'm going to hold off. We'll just stop it there. Sorry to break up another chapter. a chapter in this book. I've done pretty good so far, but this one is long, 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 long. And we've already covered now Grover Cleveland and McKinley and, what was it, Benjamin Harrison, I think. So we knocked down a few there. Next time we're going to look at a few others, Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, and we'll see what Rich Pettigrew has to say about them and his personal interactions and dealings with them. So stick around. As always, you've been listening to the File and Claw audiobook archive presentation of Triumph and Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington, the story of American public life from 1870 to 1920, written by Richard Franklin Pettigrew, the first senator from the state of South Dakota. And as always, this is the history that you're not supposed to know about. Mr. President, we tried the slower method of disposing of slavery and polygamy in the